Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Shabbat shalom. We are in Book of Numbers today. That sounds right. 20-something. 20... Balak. Yes, Balak. Not black. Ha ha ha. So funny. We are in the section of Balak. It was Numbers 22. Numbers 22 through chapter 25, the verse, I think it's verse 9 or 10. Double check that here. That's okay. Verse 9. Chapter 25, verse 9. So Numbers 22, verse 2 to 25, verse 9. The section's called Balak. Change color here. Named after the king. Numbers 22. Balak, son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorite. Moab became very frightened of the people, because it was numerous, and Moab was disgusted in the face of the children of Israel. Moab said to the elders of Midian, "Now the congregation will lick up our entire surroundings, as an ox licks up the greenery of the field." Balak, son of Zippor, was king of Moab at that time. He sent messengers to Balaam, son of Beor, to Pethor, which by the river, of the land of the members of his people, to summon him, saying, "Behold, a people has come out of Egypt. Behold, it has covered the surface of the earth, and it sits opposite me. So now, please come, curse this people for me, for it is too powerful for me. Perhaps I will be able to strike it and drive it away from the land. For I know that whomever you bless is blessed, and whoever you curse is accursed." The elders of Moab and the elders of Midian went with charms in their hand, and they came to Balaam and spoke to him the words of Balak. He said to them, "Spend the night here, and I shall give you a response, as the Lord shall speak to me." So the officers of Moab stayed with Balaam. God came to Balaam and said, "Who are these men with you?" Balaam said to God, "Balak, son of Zippor, king of Moab, sent to me. Behold, the people coming out of Egypt has covered the surface of the earth. Now go and curse it for me. Perhaps I'll be able to make war against it and drive it away." God said to Balaam, "You shall not go with them. You shall not curse people, for it is blessed." Balaam rose in the morning and said to the officers of Balak, "Go to your land, for the Lord refuses to let me go with you." The officers of Moab arose and came to Balak and said, "Balaam refused to go with us." Balak kept on sending officers, more and higher ranking than these. They came to Balaam and said to him, "So said Balak, son of Zippor, do not refrain from going to me, for I shall honor you greatly, and everything that you say to me I shall do. So go now and curse this people for me." Balaam answered and said to the servants of Balak, "If Balak will give me his house full of silver and gold, I cannot transgress the word of the Lord, my God, to do anything small or great. And now, you too, stay here for the night, and I will know what the Lord will speak with me." God came to Balaam that night and said to him, "If the men came to summon you, arise and go with them. But only the thing that I shall speak to you, that shall you do." Balaam rose in the morning and saddled his she-donkey and went with the officers of Moab. God's wrath flared because he was going, and an angel of the Lord stood on the road to impede him. He was riding on his she-donkey, and two young men were with him. The she-donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing on the road with his sword drawn in his hand. So the she-donkey turned away from the road and went out into the field. Then Balaam struck the she-donkey to turn it back onto the road. The angel of the Lord then stood in the path of the vineyards, a fence on this side and a fence on that side. The she-donkey saw the angel of the Lord and pressed against the wall. It pressed Balaam's leg against the wall, and he continued to strike it. The angel of the Lord went further and stood in a narrow place. There was no room to turn right or left. The she-donkey saw the angel of the Lord and crouched beneath Balaam. Balaam's anger flared, and he struck the she-donkey with the staff. The Lord opened the mouth of the she-donkey, and it said to Balaam, "What have I done to you that you struck me these three times?" Balaam said to the she-donkey, "Because you mocked me. If only there were a sword in my hand, I would now have killed you." The she-donkey said to Balaam, "Am I not your she-donkey that you have ridden upon all your life until this day? Have I been accustomed to do such things to you?" He said, "No." The Lord uncovered Balaam's eyes, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing on the road with his sword drawn in his hand. He bowed his head and prostrated himself on his face. The angel of the Lord said to him, "For what reason did you strike your she-donkey these three times? Behold, I went out to impede you, for you hastened on a road to oppose me. The she-donkey saw me and turned away from me these three times. Had it not turned away from me, I would now even have killed you and let it live." Balaam said to the angel of the Lord, "I have sinned, for I did not know that you were standing opposite me on the road. And now, if it is evil in your eyes, I shall return." The angel of the Lord said to Balaam, "Go with the men, but only the word that I shall speak to you, that shall you speak." So Balaam went with the officers of Balak. Now Balak heard that Balaam had come, and so he went out toward him to the city of Moab, which on the border of Arnon, which at the edge of the border. Balak said to Balaam, "Did I not urgently send you to summon you? Why did you not go to me? Am I not capable of honoring you?" Balaam said to Balak, "Behold, now I have come to you. Am I empowered to say anything? Whatever the word God puts into my mouth, that shall I speak." Balaam went to Balak, and went with Balak, and they came to Kirath Hazot. Balak slaughtered cattle and sheep and sent to Balaam and the officers who were with him. And it was the morning, Balak took Balaam and brought him up to the heights of Baal. And from there he saw the edge of the people. Chapter 23. Balaam said to Balak, "Build for me here 7 altars and prepare for me 7 bulls and 7 rams." Balak did as Balaam had spoken, and Balak and Balaam brought up a bull and a ram on each altar. Balaam said to Balak, "Stand by your offering while I go. Perhaps the Lord will happen toward me and show me something that I can tell you." He went alone. Now God happened upon Balaam, and he said to him, "I have prepared the 7 altars and brought up a bull and a ram on each altar." The Lord put an utterance in Balaam's mouth and said, "Go back to Balak, and thus you shall say." He returned to him, and behold, he was standing by his burnt offering, he and the officers of Moab. He declaimed his parable and said, "From Aram, Balak, king of Moab, led me from the mountains of the east. Come, curse Jacob for me. Come, bring anger upon Israel. How can I curse? God is not cursed. How can I anger? The Lord is not angry. For from its origins I see it, rock-like. From the hills do I see it. Behold, it is a nation that will dwell in solitude and will not be reckoned among the nations. Who has counted the dust of Jacob or numbered a quarter of Israel? May my soul die the death of the upright, and may my end be like his." Balak said to Balaam, "What have you done to me? To curse my enemy have I brought you. Behold, you've even blessed them." He spoke up and said, "Is it not so that whatever the Lord puts in my mouth, that I must take heed to speak?" Balak said to him, "Go now with me to a different place, which you will see them. However, you will see its edge, but not see all of it. And you will curse it for me from there." He took him to the field of the lookouts, to the top of the peak. He built 7 altars and brought up a bull and a ram on each altar. He said to Balak, "Stand here by your burnt offering, and I will be happened upon here. The Lord happened upon Balaam and put an utterance in his mouth and said, "Go back to Balak, and so shall you say." He came to him and said, "Behold, he was standing by his burnt offering, and the officers of Moab were with him." Balak said to him, "What did the Lord speak?" He declaimed his parable and said, "Stand erect, O Balak, and hear. Give ear to me, O son of Zippor. God is not a man that he should be deceitful, nor a son of man that he should relent. Would he say and not do, or speak and not confirm it? Behold, to bless I have received. He has blessed, and I shall not contradict it. He has perceived no iniquity in Jacob, and saw no perversity in Israel. The Lord his God is with him, and the friendship of the king is in him. It is God who brought them out of Egypt according to the power of his loftiness. For there is no divination in Jacob, and no sorcery in Israel. Even now it is said to Jacob and to Israel, what God has wrought. Behold, the people will arise like a lion cub, and raise itself up like a lion. It will not lie down until it consumes prey. It drinks the blood of the slain." Balak said to Balaam, "Neither shall you curse them at all, nor shall you bless them at all." Balaam answered and said to Balak, "Have I not spoken to you, saying, whatever the Lord shall speak, that I shall do?" Balak said to Balaam, "Go now, I shall take you to a different place. Perhaps it will be proper in God's eyes that you will curse him for me from there." Balak took Balaam to the summit of the height that overlooks the face of the wasteland. Balaam said to Balak, "Build me 7 altars and prepare for me 7 bulls and 7 rams." Balak did as Balaam said, and he brought up a bull and a ram on each altar. Chapter 24. Balaam saw that it was good in the Lord's eyes to bless Israel, so he did not go, as every other time, toward divinations. But he set his face toward the wilderness. Balaam raised his eyes and saw Israel dwelling according to its tribes, and the Spirit of God was upon him. He declaimed his parable and said, "The words of Balaam, son of Beor, the words of the man with the open eye, the words of the one who hears the sayings of God, who sees the vision of the Shaddai while fallen and with uncovered eyes. How goodly are your tents, O Jacob, your dwelling places, O Israel, stretching out like brooks, like gardens by river, like aloes planted by the Lord, like cedars by the water. Water shall flow from its wells, and his seed shall be by abundant waters. His king shall be exalted over Agag. His kingdom shall be upraised. It is God who brought him out of Egypt, according to the power of his loftiness. He will consume the nations that oppress him and crush their bones, and his arrows shall pierce them. He crouched and lay down like a lion cub. Who can stand him up? Those who bless you are blessed, and those who curse you are cursed." Balak's anger flared against Balaam. He clapped his hands, and Balak said to Balaam, "To curse my enemies that I summon you, and behold, you have continually blessed them these 3 times. Now, flee to your place. I said I would honor you, but behold, the Lord has withheld you from honor." Balaam said to Balak, "Did I not speak to your emissaries whom you sent to me, saying, if Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I cannot transgress the word of the Lord to go do good or bad on my own? Whatever the Lord speaks, that shall I speak. And now behold, I go to my people. Come, I shall advise you what this people will do to your people in the end of days." He declaimed his parable and said, "The words of Balaam, son of Beor, the words of man with the eye open, the words of the one who hears the sayings of God and knows the knowledge of the Supreme One, who sees the vision of Shaddai while fallen and with uncovered eyes. I see him, but not now. I shall look at him, but it is not near. A star issued from Jacob, and a scepter bearer has risen from Israel. He shall pierce the nobles of Moab and undermine the children of Set. Edom shall be a conquest, and Seir shall be the conquest of his enemies, and Israel will attain success. One from Jacob shall rule and destroy the remnant of the cities." He saw Amalek and declaimed this parable and said, "Amalek is the first among nations, but its end will be eternal destruction." He saw the Kenite and declaimed his parable and said, strong is your dwelling, and set in a rock is your nest. For if the Kenite should be laid waste, to where can Assyria take you captive? He declaimed his parable and said, oh, who will survive when he imposes these? Big ships from the coast of Kittim will afflict Assyria, and afflict the other bank, but it too will be forever destroyed. Then Balaam rose up and went to return to his place, and Balak also went on his way. Chapter 25. Israel settled in the Shittim, and the people began to commit harlotry with the daughters of Moab. They invited people to the feasts of their gods. People ate and prostrated themselves to their gods, and Israel became attached to Baal Peor. And the wrath of the Lord flared up against Israel. The Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people, hang them before the Lord against the sun, and the flaring wrath of the Lord will withdraw from Israel. Moses said to the judges of Israel, let each man kill his men who are attached to Baal Peor. Behold, then a man from the children of Israel came and brought a Midianite woman near to his brothers, in the sight of Moses, in the sight of the entire assembly, the children of Israel. And they were weeping at the entrance of the tent of meeting. Phinehas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, the Kohen, saw. And he stood up from amid the assembly and took a spear in his hand. He followed the Israelite man into the tent and pierced them both, the Israelite man and the woman, into her stomach. And the plague was then halted from upon the children of Israel. Those who died in the plague were 24,000. That's Parashat Balak, Numbers 22 through 1st chapter 25. Interesting story. Any comments, questions, or things I can answer for you for this part of the story? Yes, Jared.
He didn't sound surprised when he was talking to a donkey.
Yes.
Was he like so mad he didn't notice he was talking to a donkey? Or has he talked to animals before?
That's a good question. Honestly, I can't speak to how much he experienced before, whether he spoke to donkeys previously or other animals. A little Dr. Doodle going on there. The way in which Balaam experiences God is a particular manifestation. As it records here a number of times, What method does God speak to Balaam in? Each time Balak came to the men, what did Balaam tell them? Stay here and wait, and I'll see what God says. I'll go divine that evening to stay overnight. So Balaam's method of speaking to God, his divination method... Divination? This one's an I? Whatever. His divination process is dominantly one-fold. It's a vision process, which he's in like a trance type of divination procedure. That's his method which he speaks to God. So when you're in a trance, I'm not saying you've been, neither have I, but I'm sure some people have been, your mind isn't all that strong. Because your focus is one thing, your mind drifts about in other areas. If you ever get a chance to read, you're kind of young yet, but when you will, there's a number of different books about what they call Jewish trance, which is they focus on Jewish letters, the alphabet, various other things, try to get themselves in this to try to speak to the spirits. Don't do that. The point is, they read about it. And what they describe is they get the strange visions in their heads. Crazy things like being on a drug high. It's kind of strange. But in that process, this is what Balaam uses to speak to God, or speak to at least a spirit that speaks to him indirectly. What form, what images does Balaam see while he's in these trances? We don't know. You know, what he's visually, is it just hearing things? He's seeing things too? He says he speaks with his eyes open, so his eyes are open in this process of his trance-like meditation state. But your mind goes crazy when you do things like that. So it's possible in his trance-like state, he actually speaks and sees strange things all the time, speaking to him. So in which case, he's seeing a donkey in real life speaking to him may not be so shocking as it would be to a normal human being. Possibly. What was that?
Peyote.
Well, it's a strange idea of how we see things. But when somebody is in a meditative state, meditating on something to try to contact or talk with spirits, You see a lot of strange things in it. You probably have heard of, it's very few who've made a name for themselves in the entertainment world, of trying to do this type of work, and try to contact spirits and do various things. Well, in the process of doing that, of contacting spirits, they see strange stuff. And in case also we have the example for when Saul contacts the Witch of Endor and gets Samuel to rise up. Now note, when she sees this image, Saul doesn't, but she sees it. She sees this image. We assume when she saw him, she recognized who the image looked like. Assuming she knew what Samuel looked like. So she's seeing stuff. She's speaking to spirits. She's seeing strange things. So it's possible he may have been accustomed to seeing odd things. He's not the only one who used divination. Endor, obviously, Witch of Endor would use it. Also, it says Joseph also used divination cup, or how he divines or speaks to God in his imagery or in his dreams. Daniel also used dreams. A number of them used dreams and visions. Now, if you recall earlier, when Moses and Miriam attacked or assaulted verbally, of course, Aaron and Miriam assaulted Moses, God instructed them and corrected them, hey, through you and through other prophets, I will speak to visions and dreams. But Moses speaks face to face. So using visions and dreams is not abnormal in God's communication style for almost all of his prophets. Isaiah went through it, Ezekiel goes through it, they all go through visions and dreams and seeing strange stuff in the process of God speaking to them. Right, they ask him, what is this vision? I don't understand it. Explain what this means. And he'll either answer it through questions or answer it through details of expounding what the vision means. So having a vision or an imagery of God speaking to you is not abnormal so much as it is Moses would be because he spoke him face to face. So seeing a strange donkey speaking to you, if you're accustomed to seeing strange things, it wouldn't necessarily surprise you. That makes sense? Okay. Any other comments, questions, or opinions about this section? Yes, Rose. Or, sorry, her hair was up first. Go ahead, Deanne.
So is it Balak we're talking about that does the divining?
Balaam does. Sorry, okay. I write his name down. So Balak's the king. Balaam is the prophet.
What is Balaam? I don't know what Balaam is. Is he an actual man of God, or is he a half, sort of, half man for God, or a half Azatan thing?
No, he's not a Satan worshiper.
So is he... He doesn't seem like he's a true believer to me.
Details of Balaam. Well, there's a few details we know about him, and very little that would be on that.
Balaam means not my people. His name means not my people.
Not of mine, right.
On the oxen and the ram, I have in my writings, I have the ram is the sin offering. What's the oxen?
He gave an oxen. Ram, sin offerings are usually goats, typically.
Well, what's the oxen? Both?
These are all burnt offerings, completely burned up. So they're one of two forms, either free will. Actually, they're all free will. The free will offerings, like they're giving up all burnt up, so people themselves don't eat them. You would use these type of offerings for either free will or for atonement purposes. So those type two applications. We'll discuss a bit about that and how they're being used in this form shortly when we get to that section of it. Because it is relevant as far as what Balaam is telling Balak to do. It's not just an arbitrary, go kill things. He actually tried to do it on purpose. It means something. Yes.
The thing with Balaam or Balaam's name, meaning like not my people or not of my people, but yet when he first speaks in the presence of Balak, one of the first things he mentions is that he is from Aram. So he's from the same nation or same area where Abraham and his family had settled probably, 300 or 400 years before?
Yep, thereabouts.
So he's from that same nation.
Yep.
But it's ironic that he is of that nation, but he's not of... Whose people is he not of? He's not really of God's people. That's the interesting play on words.
The detail of who he belongs to. So let's discuss a little bit about Balaam. It doesn't tell us a lot about his history. Obviously, he's son of Beor, from Pethor, blah, blah, blah. That's about all we know. He's from Aram. Well, as Tammy correctly pointed out, there's some details we can extrapolate, which means you're going down on a ledge here. Be careful. Another term for extrapolation. Is that he's from Aram. Where is Aram? Well, in this little... I'll scale my other rock. I'll put this other chart up here, draw a little map of Aram. It's where Abraham is from. And where Rebecca comes from, and where Rachel and Leah all come from, the same general area. So Mediterranean Sea is over here. Israel is this little tiny little snippet of land. And then you have, let's see here, the Red Sea. Sorry, Red Sea. This is the Gulf of Arabia. Thank you. Gulf of Arabia, and you have the Red Sea over here with its little branches, the Sinai Peninsula. And you have the Black Sea's up here, and Caspian's off the side. Here's a bunch of mountains. Mountains, 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 mountains. And you have the Tigris and Euphrates rivers going along through here. So, wow, that's a little further south. So, Aram, or the general area of Aram, is starts out over here as far as where Babylonia came from. Babylonia's over here. And so Aram is basically this area along this region, traveling north. Not to be confused with Assyria, which is right next to it, but a little bit closer. Yes. Oh, that's great. Look at that. So here's Assyria. Aram is right in... You don't have Aram on this one, do you?
Yes, in the middle. Not Aram.
Oh, there it is. Not Aram. Okay, not Aram. I had him flipped, didn't I? So this is Assyria on the other side. That makes sense. He's next to the river. So he's traveling, obviously, from this generalized area, Padan Aram, he's coming and traveling out, down to right about Moab, which is here. Well, a little further north. Right about there. Now, the other side of the Dead Sea. Who is he from? Where did he come from? Who came from Aram? What happened when Abraham left Aram? Who did he leave behind? He left his family behind. So Terah was there, who was his dad. He left two brothers. Well, one brother. Lot's dad died, and Abraham and Lot went together. But one brother was there. You have Terah, of course. He has Haran. Nahor. That was it. Nahor. Haran dies. Nahor continues on living. He continues on. We get Nahor. He has a son, and then there's a Beth something. It goes on to Laban. Then continue on with other generations following after Laban, because this is where Jacob gets involved. They have more generations follow it. In Jewish tradition, Balaam is a descendant of the same family. Jewish tradition. We don't know for certain, but he's from the same family. Because no one knows for certain. Yes?
But God called them away from his family, and didn't they do pagan stuff?
Yes, many of them did. Yes.
Okay.
If you recall, when we encountered Laban the first time, which is when a servant of Abraham was sent off to go get a wife, in the case was Rebecca, and he encountered Laban for her brother. And he interacted with him, found out who he is, and the servant says, the Lord of my master, Abraham, commanded this to happen. And Laban said, well, if God said so, who are we to say otherwise? So at that time, he recognized there was a particular God that Abraham followed and traveled along. He also, however, had multiple idols and gods with him in his own belief and own system. So Laban's family line have already diverted off into idol worship to some degree. How extensive it was, we don't know. But enough of it, because even afterward, when Jacob comes and Laban's two daughters with Rachel and Leah, they leave. Rachel steals or takes some of the idols of Laban's house. And of course, he's all upset about it, yada, yada, yada. So we know there's idol worship along there. And when Jacob's in Israel, before God says, you come back to Bethel, Jacob tells all of his people, okay, everybody, bury all your idols. Dump them, bury them, collect them all, get rid of them all, and then we'll go up to offer up to God. So Jacob knew idol worship was prevalent in this family. It wasn't going away easily. So he knows where they came from. Just because they came from there doesn't mean every individual was an idol worshiper. Note, there's other descendants. They also believe the book of Job. He's also one of these descendants, also the same, from a similar line family. We actually have a genealogy of him. He is from this general line. But he's interacting with this line. He's in the same region that Balaam is from. They're all in the same generalized area. Now, Job is a contemporary, believed to be, of Joseph. Yeah, he's in Egypt. Where he traveled, they took the same area. But they have the individuals from here. They actually have a migration from down into the desert area, along with Job coming from this direction as well. So they all kind of mingled into the same generalized area. But each of these people, they have the same basic understanding of who God was early on. Not to say they themselves as children, but their ancestors did at some point in time understood it. Along the way of your idol worships, you may run across the real one true God. Who knows? That can happen to an individual. It depends on how God chooses to pull the Balaam. So in this route the Balaam's taking, where he came from, he is not a Satan worshiper. He is not an idol worshiper. He knows there is one God and only one true God. He recognizes that. That doesn't necessarily mean he's a good person. Have you ever run across a person who believes in God is actually a bad person, though? Yes, there are bad people who believe that there is a God. So that's not too surprising. It's how God spoke to Balaam that is actually more interesting. Yes, Larry.
It's always seemed to me like he knew
he was a prophet of Yahweh.
He knew he was a prophet, yep.
And he asked, he said, I can't say anything about what Yahweh tells me. And then Yahweh says, don't go. And he says, okay, I can't go. But then when the guys came back and offered him more stuff, he said, well, I'll ask again. And really maybe what he should have said is, he said no.
Right. He already said no. He already gave you the answer.
That's it. He's not going to change his mind.
Right. He already knows he didn't change his mind. Which is funny because Balaam, even at the last blessing he gives, he says, God is not a man. They should change his mind. He even declares, what I'm doing here is against his will, how I chose to get here, that is. Was against what to start with, because Balaam is aware of God's methodology, his stance, how he does things. I'm blocking all your wind blue. Breathe. helping, it's okay, I'll bless you anyway, in spite of your evil ways. So, we know a little bit about Balaam, not a whole lot. He's from the same family area as Abraham was, so he probably has some knowledge of that. Job's example of another person who also has knowledge of Abraham's family and their God and the God-like perspective. Job, of course, is a very highly educated and honorable man, far different than Balaam was. But still, the idea is the same. And that they may not necessarily be Jewish people or Jewish people that are prophets that know God. There are Gentiles who know God, too. That's the idea behind it. He's not an isolated, so he only speaks to Abraham's immediate children through Isaac and Jacob. He speaks to many of God's creation. He created Adam and Eve too. He spoke to them also. So he spoke to many people along the way. He's not isolated to only one group. The details being how he wants his group, that this particular family line here to survive and live, is unique or distinct from the others. But he still spoke to many. So a little bit about Balaam, just a little bit. We don't have a lot of details, so I can't give you much more. He's a very smart man, too smart for his own good. Any comments or questions that I can answer for you so far? All right. Okay, so Balak sees, obviously, Israel coming out of Egypt, and they destroyed the Amorite, the Og, and Sihon. We read about that in the previous parasha reading. So, in Moab's life, that picture doesn't show it very well. In Moab's world, I'll erase this picture and do a quick blow-up. Moab's not that big of a country. It's relatively small. So, there's Israel. Moab is in the southern area down here. Ammon, who are brothers. Moab and Ammon are brothers. They're both descendants of Lot. They're in this generalized area. They occupy this territory, both of them, on the east bank of the Jordan River. Moab There are other nations around the area too. Amalek is over in Sinai Peninsula. There's Sinai Peninsula. Amalek is over in this direction here. You have, Edom is down here. And you have the Amorites, which Amorites are a little spread out. But the Amorites actually incorporated a section of this area between Amalek, Moab, and Edom. But they also occupied other areas too. Oh, does that picture show it? It goes Moab to Edom. Anyway. So Amorites had this small little strip section in this area. Amorites were a strong nation relative to Moab. So Moab had lost territory previously to the Amorite kings. We call it disputed territory, like the West Bank again, right? This territory, it's important that we note that it's recorded that this was what had happened. Because later on, Jephthah cites this example as a problem. Because Moab then says, hey, you owe us land. And yet the response to him says, no, we don't. We took it 30 years earlier, and you had already lost it to the Amorite kings who had owned the occupied that we took it from. So if anything, we owe it to the Amorites who are all dead. We don't owe anything to you. That was Jephthah's response. So these examples we have, the stories of who took what and what happens to which king, it's important because it's used later on to verify we have real claim to this, as far as in the case of Jephthah when he deals with this topic and deal with the king of Moab. So the Amorites get wiped out. They were a stronger nation. Israel killed them off. They're a stronger nation than Moab. So now Moab, who was weaker, saying, uh-oh, our neighbors who were stronger than us just got toasted by the Israelites coming out. What do we do now? Let's go talk to somebody who's bigger than us. So the Midianites, which is a little further south, Midian, a little further south than this area, they collude together to go talk to Balak, to go send message to Balak. Message to Balaam. Now it points out that both Moab, in verse 7 of chapter 22. Verse 7, the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian both went with their charms in their hand. They came to Balaam and spoke to him the words of Balak. He said, of course, spend the night here. I'll give you the response. The Lord speaks to me. So the officers of Moab stay with Balaam. So both Moab and Midian go to Balaam. However, Moab is the primary character player here, not so much Midian. Note, later on we'll read about Midian gets completely wiped out by Israel for their actions, both mostly from here, where this happens in this particular story. This plan or this idea of putting a stumbling block in Israel, that was Balaam's plan. He instructed them how to do this to make Jacob fall, make God be angry with them, to destroy them. That was his concoction. So he put it up to them. He got Midian and, of course, Moab to get together in order to destroy Israel as a team, to unite against them with a team, using, of course, pagan idol worship as well as sexual deviancy. So they both go, of course, they go back and forth. I'm going to bring something out to you, which seems relatively minor, but it shows you perspective of how God sees something. At least it shows me how God sees something. When God comes to Balaam and asks who these men are, what's Balaam say? He says, behold, people come out of Egypt, verse 11. Come out of Egypt, has covered the face of the earth. Go and curse it for me. Perhaps I'll be able to make war against it and drive it away. Verse 11, is curse. That word curse, the word that Balaam uses, is a specific type of word. It's chabah. That kabat, it means to curse to destruction. And curse them to die. To perish and make them completely annihilate them. However, when Balak actually asked them and told him, please come, Balak didn't ask for destruction. he asked for a different type of curse. In verse 8, when Balak says they come and curse these people, he used a different word. There was Tzoar, which means speak evil of them. Say, well, what difference does it make? Huge. You do not speak. When God's response to Balaam, when God acts, when God says, you shall not curse these people, God uses another word. You shall not speak evil of them. So Balaam interpreted Balak's request to curse, to destroy. Of course, this is Balaam's profession, so he does, that's what he does for a living. So this is a good thing for him. He gets paid well for that. But Balak's request and God's response was, don't even speak evil of them. That's beyond don't curse them, destroy them. Don't even speak bad about them. Don't even be on their bad side. That's not an acceptable behavior either. So God and Balak both were not on Balaam's camp. When Balaam wanted to go curse to destroy, this is how he gets paid, by the way. This is business, his line of work. So Balaam wanted to curse to destroy. Both Balak and God, Balak said, curse to speak evil, and God said, don't even speak evil. You can't do any of these things. That was God's response. You don't even get to speak evil of Jacob. It's important that we note these differences. It tells us the heart of where Balaam is. God said, don't even speak evil of them. And Balaam said, can I destroy them? Essentially what Balaam is discussing. And when we understand Balaam's point or his heart behind this, it explains or helps explain why God said, okay, go, and then puts an angel in front of him and says, you're opposing me. He's going beyond. Balaam's heart is to destroy. That is his intent. That's his goal or his objective, to curse, to destroy. We have that term, you shall have a blessing or cursing that comes out of the same mouth. Yeah. You don't even get to speak evil out of the same mouth of someone. Lashon hara, this evil tongue. Don't even speak evil of someone. Now, Balaam's responses to the people of... Again, this is more understanding Balaam's sense of thought. We're doing this because it explains more as to why the donkey had to save him three times. There are the different ways which Balaam saw things and how he was trying to manipulate his world, which then, when we understand why or how God saved him three times, what the purpose of the donkey was, and that part of the story, we understand where Messiah is living his life in Balaam's story. It makes a better explanation of what's happening. So Balaam's heart is to curse, to destroy. That's where his heart, remember that. His heart's to curse, to destroy. So, when the men came to Balaam the first time, of course, talked about this, God says, of course, don't go with them and don't even speak evil of them. And then, when Balaam replied to the man, I can't go with you, what word choice did he use? Let's jump to verse 14. Oh, sorry. This was their response. Verse 13. But there arose the morning, said the officer of Balak, go your way, for the Lord refuses to let me go with you. The officer of Moab arose, came to Balak, said, Balaam refused to go with us. Balaam left the door open while he refused to go with you by saying the word, go with you. As if you were better, if you had a greater offering, this could be more advantageous to me. That was the impression he purposefully let the Moabite leaders believe. So when they went, they didn't say the Lord would not let Balaam go with us. They said Balaam refused to go with us. As in, like, instead of going with us, going with just plain us. It's us is the problem. The people you sent go offer more. So Balaam very well played Moab. Said, okay, I can't go with you, meaning these individuals who come. So Balak sends more money and more higher-ranking officials, other than himself, of course, is one go. And that, of course, just brings him through it. So Balaam used Moab to up the ante a little bit. Give me a higher price. Give me more money for this endeavor you're actually offering. Now, Did God say, Balaam, you can't go with them, they didn't pay you enough money? Did God say you have to ask for money for you, then you can go? Of course not. God said, don't even go. Don't go with them, don't even speak evil of them. You can't go with them, you can't speak evil of them. The next group, God, of course, they come back, offer more money, better honors, whatever the promises may be. Balaam, of course, already knows God's answer, as Larry pointed out earlier. He knows what the response is, he can't go with them, but he asks anyway, because why? Again, this is Balaam's line of work. He does cursing and blessings for a living. He's paid by kings, he's paid by countries to curse and to bless. That's what he does. He makes his living that way. This is obviously a lot of money. This is where this is his enjoyment of life. We pay a lot of entertainers similarly for their making our lives seem better than they are. So, Block B, of course, has better honor. Balaam finally goes back and asks God again. He persists to ask again. Finally, God says, go with you. Why did God change his mind? God finally said, go with him. The second time, God already told him, don't go with his men and don't even speak evil of the people of coming out of Egypt. And now, second time, God says, go with these men, but only say what I tell you to say. Yeah, he knew he was going to go anyway. Nothing so shocking about that. He knew Balaam's heart, what his intent was. Sorry, I didn't hear that. Say it a little louder.
From God.
No, he was not asking permission. Essentially, Balaam is telling God, I'm going to go with this man. Is that cool with you? If not, I'm going with him anyway. Is that still cool with you? That was Balaam's intent, because his heart is to destroy and to earn money. That's his living. That's what he does for a living. Nothing surprising. So, Balaam obviously goes. What's Balaam's intent still? Remember, curse to destroy. That's how you get paid. God said, don't even speak evil. But Balaam's intent in going is curse to destroy. So Balaam is choosing to go. God's not going to stop him. He probably could if he wanted to, but obviously Balaam's heart is intense to do this. So he obviously says, finally, go. I do want to point out one detail, which I think is minor, but it could be a legitimate point. I will give some credit to some people who have argued this before. In verse 20, when God responds to Balaam that at nighttime, this is in his vision, his trance-like state. Verse 20, God said, if the men came to summon you, arise and go with them. But the only thing I shall speak to you, that shall you do. Now many point out that in verse 21, did he wait for them to come to him?
No, he went running off.
No, he got up early in the morning, saddled his own donkey, and went off with the officers of Moab. Did they come back to him in the morning and say, hey, are you going to come with us or not? No, they didn't. He didn't wait that long. He saddled his donkey early in the morning before they're probably even awake and said, let's go. So I don't think he actually listened or followed through with God's instruction, but that's just my personal opinion, because it was brought up that it's possible that Balaam manipulated God's words in a way that God said, hey, I didn't tell them to come to you. They didn't come back to you. You followed and sought after them. Again, it tells us the heart of Balaam. Where's his heart? To destroy. That's what he does. He's good at it. There's a number of people in the Bible who are good at destroying and are smart people at the same time. Yes.
To go with you, when he refused to let him go, he uses a different word, and then he tells him, go with them, it's a different word than he refused to let them go.
Oh, really? I didn't catch that.
So is it one to walk with them, but not to agree with them, and one to go in agreement with them?
I'd have to look that up. I do not know. I did not notice that difference in the word choice. I noticed the difference of this word. I didn't notice the difference of the form of go, going with. I'd have to look it up to find out what it means. So I don't know. Those of you who might have your own automatic little computer eyes can figure that out for me if you want to. That would help to answer that question, because I don't have the answer for it. So Balaam, of course, goes. He says, I only have to go what God says. Of course, now we have our three events of the donkey. So verse 22, God's wrath flared because he was going. An angel Lord stood the roadside. I'm not going to go through all different, each of the individual stories. Balaam, of course, not traveling alone. There's men with him. I'm assuming the men with Balaam couldn't hear the donkey speak. But I don't know. They're his servants. It'd be really funny if they couldn't. But that's just my personal opinion. Because, to be honest, God was making a fool of Balaam. And it just accentuates the foolishness. If you're talking to this horse, this animal, and the people around you can't hear the animal talking back to you. It's, anyway, just my opinion. Yes.
You know what kind of reminded me of just a little bit, the thing that flashed in my mind when you're reading this text aloud was when Paul was on his way to Damascus. Paul was not by himself either.
No, he wasn't.
But he says that he was the only one that heard the voice.
Yes.
So you have the same scenario. He gets knocked off his horse. He's gone blind. He can't see anything. And he's babbling to something. You know, no one else can hear what he's talking about.
Yep.
So it's the same thing as like the donkey.
It's on purpose.
Yeah.
This story of Balaam and Saul and Paul are attached together on purpose. They are correct mirror images of each other's stories. Not duplicates, but they're similar on purpose. They mean the same thing. Yes, Jeff.
That's why I thought it was curious that it was talking about the donkey, because one of the donkey symbols is of Israel.
Yes,
so
it is.
Thus, it's like, why are you beating me?
Yes.
And to the prophet who is now going to be hired to curse Israel.
Exactly. The Apostle Paul and Balaam, essentially, you could just swap their names. They're doing the same thing in their stories. Apostle Paul's going off to persecute or destroy a people that God has blessed. And that God has brought out of their Egypt out of sin. So, Apostle Paul thinks he's doing God's work. That God's with him. God's on his side. He's being paid to do this work. There are men with him. He's traveling along this country and these countrysides to kill these people and bring them, arrest them, and destroy them. He's doing what Balaam was doing. They're the same story. They're on purpose. Balaam's story isn't there for the fun of it. It's there because we're learning something about what God's going to do with another man 1,000+ years later. What's happened? These are mirror images of each other's stories. They're tied together on purpose. So as Balaam gets to hear this donkey and his eyes were opened to seeing the angel, obviously Apostle Paul's eyes, or Saul at the time, well, it depends on how he was named. His eyes are closed, but he can hear the angel, can see it obviously while it's speaking. And then Saul has to relearn everything for how many years? 3 years. The Apostle Paul goes, conceals himself, and relearns the entire Bible, Torah, everything all over again. Well, before he preaches. He starts preaching it after 3 years. So that after he has to relearn, what is this? What am I seeing? I don't understand this. Well, he has spent his entire life studying the Torah and the Gospel, or the Gospel, Torah and the Prophets. Well, now,
without a Messiah,
now he has to relearn them for 3 years with. So he's relearning them. Well, Balaam has to relearn too. These are the three times which he's being spared by this donkey who he's beating. So we have a lot of similarities in these stories. It's on purpose. Yes.
And that similarity is the reason that I believe that this angel of the Lord may very well be Yeshua.
I'm inclined to think so too. It's a personal opinion that most of the interactions of humans with God in the Old Testament, the Torah itself, is Messiah speaking to. That's my personal opinion, because that's the most common sense that makes sense what we're seeing. So yeah, it would have been, again, the same character doing the work. The same one that goes before them, the fights or the battles, same individual. Yes, Dan.
And in the Hebrew scriptures, the Aleph and the Tav, Messiah said he is the Aleph and the Tav. So when you're studying your scriptures, and I happen to have the Aleph Tav, that's how I was doing the studies and realizing that that's Messiah all through the Old Testament.
The Aleph Tav, the Et, it has no translation in English because we don't use it that way. The Aleph Tav is a word, a legitimate word, if I recall correctly. It's an identifying article. I mean, it identifies who's doing what to whom. It identifies... So you can have, for example...
It's the definite article singular.
Yeah, so you have person A is talking to person B. Well, we use the word A talked to B. Well, Hebrew says A talk B. As A talked to B or A got talked to by B, we don't know. Who talked to who? We use the et to identify who did the actual talking, who got the listening to, who had to deal with what. So God, or the Aleph Tav, beginning, the end, which is a lot of people frequently use the term et to define him as his identifying marker. It essentially, you can look at it that way. There's nothing wrong with that. It's when what we're doing is that the actual ability to assign who does what is where the et comes from. Who is assigned to do something, to actually be what they are and do what they're doing. How do you get anything? Through God. So does God assign you what you are? Yep. Does he give you your tasks to do? Yep. He is the assigner. So there's a gentleman who wrote a book about this, a little pamphlet, I'm going to pull a book, about the et, the how it was used in Hebrew, et, the aleph tav, aleph tav et, how it was used in Hebrew, and he attempted to assign that to meaning the all inclusive. No, sorry, that was God, the name of God, which is not a fair assessment. It's more of the that is the article of language of how you assign who does something, who is one doing it, and who's not doing it, who's one having it being done to. The et is actually a real Hebrew word identifying article of application, who does what. But it also God used the term, the aleph of the tav, meaning I am the beginning and the end, also the one who assigns who does what to whom. I am the decider. It's the same way of looking at it. So it's an interesting way of analyzing or looking at that particular phrase, the aleph tav, the et, in Hebrew word. It is used both in two ways. God says, inclusive of everything, and also who assigns who to do what to whom. So it's a very broad spectrum as well as a very narrow spectrum. He used that word, in Hebrew, he used the word for both applications. It's a very interesting analysis. But I don't discuss it all in great detail today, but it's a very interesting way of looking at stuff. Where was I? Oh, right. So we have Saul's story, we have Balaam's story. We have more parallels or similarities in these stories. So, in the case of the donkey speaking, so we'll erase this one. Anytime you have the number 3 and death, and life attached to the storyline, you are speaking about Messiah. In one way or another. Because that's what he is. He's old, dead 3 days, 3 nights, and something that is dead or what should be dead is converted into life. Or something that is alive is converted into death. Because he does both ways. Both he died as our sin offering, so life turned into death. At the same time, he made us live through our sin offering, turned our death into life. So he does both applications. So in this instance, we have the character of 3 by the donkey. The 3 times donkey saves Balaam's life. And each time Balaam should have died in each of those instances. But instead, what did he do? God said, or the donkey, through the donkey's actions, he turned Balaam's life, death, into life. Did Balaam know it? No. As Jeff pointed out earlier, the donkey... Now note, this is a she donkey, not necessarily he donkey, but the donkey's symbol in general... If it is a he donkey, which is a male donkey, that is strictly symbolic of firstborn. Not just any firstborn, firstborn of symbolic only of men. The beast of burden, he's a firstborn son. That's a symbolic of a he donkey. A she donkey is traditionally symbolic of Israel. Or the nation of Jacob, the whole house of all 12 tribes. So the firstborn of man and the nation of Israel, and who's Balaam riding on? He's riding the she-donkey. And he's beating it. Persecuting the... And symbolically speaking, beating the firstborn... Sorry, beating Israel into submission or attacking it. And what's Israel doing? Saving his life. So he's attacking the one who is saving him. He's attacking the one who God has then allowed. Did God allow the donkey to see him? Yes. Did God allow the donkey to see the angel? Did God let Balaam see the angel? Not till the third time. So the donkey, meaning Israel, could see and understand. So Israel could understand. Israel understood what they were doing and what their actions were, because this is the symbolic of what Balaam's going to go do, to go attack the nation that's come out of Egypt known as Jacob. But they see things correctly. Jacob's following God's instructions. They understand things, they're doing things right, and Balaam's going there to attack them. Well, the she-donkey is representative of Israel too. What will Balaam do? 3 times. Strike, well, the 3 events. I don't know how many times he struck him each time, but to strike the donkey each of these 3 times. Balaam doesn't understand that through this method, through this understanding that the donkey understood, Israel is the salvation tool for Balaam. How's that possible? How can Israel, the nation of Jacob, coming out of Egypt, how are they a tool for Balaam? It's going to save Balaam's life. Second level nation. What's God say about this particular nation? They're unique, they're strange, they're oddballs. What's so odd about them?
Everything.
There's nothing normal about them. How they act, how they treat one another. This would be a shining light to be a spectacle amongst the nations of what is good versus what is not good. So Israel's understanding in this instance, which we read in Balaam's third prophecy, or third parable, he cites them, he understands that Israel is a unique body. It's strange compared to everybody else, all the other nations. He points out that Israel will not be reckoned among the other nations. Means will not be considered equal or judged with them. To be reckoned with means to be justified with or judged with another individual, another piece. So Israel will not be judged among the other nations in the day of judgment. They are unique or unique category. So Balaam understood this and followed this train of thought in his prophecies of speaking and blessing Israel. But leading up to that, he had to understand that Israel is the process in which Balaam will be saved, because Israel is the one who's turning his death into life. And how do they do it? How does Jacob turn Balaam's death into life? How did the people of God follow or teach Saul and turning his death into life? What'd they do? What happened to Saul for 3 years as he was relearning everything? He was Paul. Sorry. Saul, Paul. It's Greek versus Hebrew, whatever. What was happening to him? What did they do for those years? What did God tell him to go do? They remember? Say it again?
Exile?
No, he had to go see someone. He had to go see someone. Who did he go see? I mean, yeah, he had to go see Paul. See, where are they? I didn't even write down what the chapter is. Chapter 9, yeah, of Acts. Let's see, it's at verse Damascus, Saul persecuting me, kick against the goads. Verse 3 days without sight. So he's blind for 3 days, ate nor drank. That's verse 9 of 9. And a certain man, Ananias. There's Ananias to go, of course. Ananias go to the street and call straight and inquire of the house of Judas, one called Saul. Oh no, bad guy, don't want to see him, yada, yada, yada. He has the authority of the peace to bind and attack everybody. Go, for he's a chosen vessel of mine, verse 15, to bear my name for the Gentiles, kings, and children of Israel. Oh, yes. This is what Balaam did. He did that exact verse. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, the guy's name is a form of Hananiah, which means blessing of God. So go see the blessing of God.
Hey, I didn't even catch that. That's great. Okay, so in this case, we have an interesting character happening. So in this process of Saul, who is acting out Balaam in this idea of going to curse God and curse the people of God, he thinks he understands God really, really well. Of course he doesn't. But he thinks he does. He has to get there and understand him. When the process of Saul, which I didn't even catch, that's brilliant, I didn't spot the blessing process. Balaam has to learn about God and learn about the salvation and understand what Israel does through blessings. And of course, he suffers the three attempts of his life and yada, yada, yada. Saul has to relearn, of course, he's blinded for 3 days. He has to relearn and go to Ananias and understand what Saul's job then. What is he assigned to do in that verse? Go preach to who? To who?
Gentiles.
Yeah. When Balaam blessed, who was hearing Balaam's words? Moab. What are those? Gentiles. Moab is Gentiles. They're descendants, but they're still all Gentiles. We think, oh, well, but no, they are. They're all Gentiles. All the whole family line is. So Saul and Balaam are actually both assigned to do the same thing. You get that? They both give the same instructions. Go do this. So Balaam, as we mentioned earlier, was not a good man necessarily. Well, we lost it already. I erased it. In that he was a prophet. He's a prophet to the Gentiles. I mean, in Balaam's instruction, his life, his experience, was he, throughout his whole existence of growing up and becoming a professional cursing and blessing man, that was his job. He was not a prophet to Israel, he was a prophet to the Gentiles. That's where he lived, among the sons of Aram. Well, Saul's instruction, he wanted to do the exact same thing. Go prophet the Gentiles. So Saul and Balaam, essentially, symbolically speaking, are the same man.
Or even Balaam said, I see, but not yet.
But not yet, yes. And it was a brilliant way of looking at stuff, because Balaam also didn't even see the angel yet, but yet Balaam still sees. He's seeing in the future what's going to be happening. And what's going to happen in the future, he cites all these other countries. This country will come, they'll be destroyed. This one comes, they'll be destroyed. It'll happen sometime in the future. The Apostle Paul is experiencing much of that. Balaam's prophecy essentially ends, as you point out, in the tail end of his prophecy against, I think it's, who was it against? I forgot his verse 24 verse, Assyria. His last prophecy was against Assyria, that the Kittim will come in great ships. Who are the Kittim? Greeks. The Greeks come in great ships. So Balaam ends his prophecy, the Greeks will come and destroy Assyria and win and conquer everything. Well, when's Apostle Paul or Saul alive? Well, the Greeks have just been destroyed and Rome is now in charge, but the Greeks are still prevalent. So, as Balaam's prophecy continues on, his prophecy ends in his vision, and Paul then shows up where Balaam's prophecy ends, and Paul continues on.
Saul Paul.
You know, it sort of.
Spall.
Like Spalding. in Greek, the Greek uses the term Paul. In Hebrew, the term Saul or Saul. It's just two different languages speaking the same man's name. It's confusing because there's two Sauls. There's one in the King Saul, which is confused. So having two people the same name, it gets really hard. And so frequently it's used for Paul because we understand what it means. But Paul, Saul, Spall, whatever you call him, he's the man here referring to mirroring, imaging, or living the life of Balaam's story. So Balaam's story isn't an arbitrary story told about some bad guy. What do we learn from him? What his job was. He prophesied and understood the people of Israel just enough, and God opened his eyes just enough to see in order to be their true prophet and then prophesy what's going to happen to Israel. What's going to happen to these people? How they're going to save and be the dominant nation of everyone. See, he's understanding these. We have two men who are living this life thousands of years apart from each other, the same symbolic life. Does that make sense so far? I don't lose anybody as far as the idea of how these two men mirror image each other. Now, I won't go through all the details of everything, but the idea of this three death into life, we have a messianic salvation going on, happens both Balaam as well as Paul. With the same salvation going from death into life, because Saul's job or Paul's job was to go off and kill. He then converted his killing, his authority to kill, into life-giving. Not just for the followers of Israel, meaning not just for Jacob or the Jews, would Paul also help give life to all the Gentiles. That was his function, his assignment in Acts, to give the life understanding to the Gentiles too. Yes?
So what kind of a job is that anyways? Cursing and blessing people and ruining people's lives. I mean, what is that? And I'm really asking the question, what is going on with that?
Yeah, you can make a lot of money that way. Let's go back to the Torah and we'll discuss a little bit about that. In Balaam's second blessing, we understand a little bit about how this is supposed to work. Let's see, we go past the donkey speaking, Balaam's rebuke, to alter the offerings. First blessing.
Where are we at now?
This is chapter 23 of Numbers. This is 23 verse 9. So from its origins I see it like a rock. From the hills do I see it. Behold, it is a nation that will dwell in solitude and not be reckoned among the nations. Who has counted the dust of Jacob or numbered a quarter of Israel? May my soul die the death of the upright, and may my end be like his. Of course it won't be, but that's what he's hoping for. So he's understanding there's a reckoning or a uniqueness about Israel. As I already mentioned earlier, I'll erase this side. Mentioned earlier that his first blessing discusses as far as that his nation will not be reckoned, to not be reckoned. R-E-C-K. With the nations. Hold on a minute. Nations. Okay. Reckoning. To compare or to make something that is in this case, it's used for to judge or to analyze together as saying, okay, let's correct this side and correct that side to reckon them all together, make one thing. So you will not be corrected or reconciled or brought together with the other nations into one conglomerate mass of people. He will always stay unique. Now, in the case of the day of reckoning, the day of judgment, the day in which you are compared of everything you've done, compared to what you should have done, and what's going to happen to you? Let's reconcile these two accounts, or reckon what you have done versus what you have not done, what you were supposed to versus what you did do. That's reconciling, or to reckon something. And this is reckoning of nations, as you're comparing Israel to all the other nations. They are not comparable. They will not be brought and say, you should have done this, this nation was better. That won't happen to Israel. They will be always stay unique. Makes sense? They'll never be reconciled. So they will not be reckoned of the nations. Israel will never be brought low to match the other nations. It will remain always elevated. Always up. Always up higher. Always lifted up above everybody else. That will be a permanent blessing that they received. His second blessing, which also spells out Balaam's train of thought here. I like his second blessing. Interesting a lot, because what it tells a lot. Second blessing, when he goes to the next side and blah, blah, blah. Jump to verse... jump to... There. Verse 21. Verse 21 of chapter 23 of Numbers. Verse 21, it says, he, referring to God, perceived no iniquity in Jacob and saw no perversity in Israel. Lord God is with him, and the friendship of the king is in him. It is God who brought him out of Egypt according to the power of his for loftiness. There is no divination in Jacob and no sorcery in Israel. Even now is said of Jacob and Israel what God has brought. So in these two verses, verse 21, 22, and 23 verses, he understands a few identifiers. First of all, there's no iniquity. That was first blessing and second blessing. No iniquity.
It's not saying that there is no iniquity.
No, to perceive means that's what the word perceive, or to appear or see new wickedness in Jacob. He perceives or sees, does not see the wickedness in Jacob. So he either God, there is no wickedness, in this case iniquity in Jacob, or he has chosen not to see it anymore, or not observe it. Either way, God doesn't see it. Whether there isn't any, or whether he can't see it, either way, or choose not to see it, he doesn't see any wickedness in Israel, in Jacob. So the idea that God has chosen in Jacob, there is no iniquity, meaning he's not observing it, or there isn't any. I don't know which one it is.
Or it's just covered by Messiah.
Either way, it can be legitimate. The point is, he's not seeing it or perceiving it. As you continue on, there's no perversity in Israel. No iniquity, no perversity. Yeah, perverse. Perverse iniquity and a perversity. Perversity can be taken multiple different ways. In Jewish tradition, they take this turn to mean how one man treats another man. Not how one man treats God, or when necessarily treats himself. How one man treats another man. That's the idea of perversity. I'm using man generically. It can be woman to woman, man to woman. This makes a difference. The point is, how one individual treats another person. How you treat them. So there's no iniquity, which is no wickedness, which that's with your treating with God and man, because both iniquity can go either way. There's no rebellion. And perversity is how you treat other people. So no mistreating. So this is always treating with dignity, honor, or respect.
That's usually the problem with people.
It can be issues. That is true. That is common. So in these two first verses, there's no iniquity and no perversity. So we already learned that in the first blessing, he will not be reckoned among the nations. He will not be equivalent or made equal or made compared to. And God sees no rebelliousness and no and the person he has lots of respect for others. Let's continue on. Verse 23. There's no divination. That same thing. Yeah, yeah. Well, sorry, they're not quite the same. They're similar. It says there's no divination in Jacob and no sorcery in Israel. So no divination, no sorcery. How do you spell that word?
So does that mean that even the stones rise, sorcery against
Jacob? Sorcery. Hold on a minute. Okay. So divination and sorcery. What did we learn about, first let's one thing at a time, divination. What do we learn about Balaam? What does he do for a living? He's a diviner. That's what he does. He makes what is divine up there brought down low down here so people can see it, understand, and comprehend. It's the idea of that's the idea of divination, to bring what is divine and what is godly and bring it to humans to understand. It is a way of speaking or dealing with the spirit world. Oops. You can call 1-800 spirit person. Yeah, I'm sure they're, or 1-900, or whatever they are. spirit or divining a spirit or understanding spirits. To understand spirits. He does not divine. Sorcery is somewhat related to it, recall correctly, is witchcraft or form of witchcraft. T-C-H craft. Thank you. So, no type of witchcraft at all. So, where did they come out of? Egypt. What was Egypt known for?
All their gods.
Divination, sorcery, iniquities, perverse, how they treated the people. They had a lot of iniquities, rebellious. No, Pharaoh was very rebellious. So were all of his people. The perverse is how they treated the people. They treated the slaves very horribly. And where Jacob came out of, they didn't bring their baggage with them. They left the baggage in the desert for 40 years as it got strewn about and whacked off and God killed them all. He got rid of the baggage, the source, all the junk that came out of Egypt. He made sure it was all gone, erased, wiped away, thrown out. That's important because that's what explains Apostle Paul's event. If the people who are still worshiping God and Messiah come along, Messiah dies for them, and they're still full of their sins, Apostle Paul or Saul killing off and killing them, he's justified in doing so because they're still sinners. But if their sin's gone, meaning they got rid of their iniquity, they got rid of the perversity, got rid of their divination, their spiritualness, all this crazy stuff they do, all that's gone is their justification for execution. Not at all. Well, Messiah died for them, so their justification for execution was just wiped away. So, hence Saul, God says, what are you doing? What are you doing? Back off. Stop doing this. You're kicking against the goads. It's not going to work for you. That's what God tells him. Because he was trying to kill someone unjustly, doing something that they had already been paid for and taken care of. It was done and gotten rid of. Well, in this case, Balaam is recognizing the same thing. These people came out of Egypt, known for its sorcery and its pagan ways. Very good at what it does and how it treats the people and became a powerful nation. They came out of it and didn't bring it with them. That was bizarre. That's strange. How can that be? How can evil not spread its way that way? Because God didn't want it to. Yes?
Have you heard of a discerning of spirits? That kind of sounds
discerning
like...
of spirits?
Yes, discernment. Divination?
Is that the same thing? Well, I don't know how everyone uses that term, so I can't answer the question properly. I know how I use that term, discerning of spirits, but I don't know how everybody else uses the term. I use it meaning, hey, I meet so-and-so, there's something wrong with this individual. Something strange about them, there's a demon hanging around them, something I feel very uncomfortable. That's how I would discern a spirit. Also, if I hear something, okay, God, is that from you, is it not from you? Challenge and find out. That's how I use the term discerning of spirits. I don't know how somebody else may use it, so I can't answer if somebody else uses that term. That's how I use the term. Discern what is from God and what isn't. There are a lot of things out there that are not from God. Some are just from man. Some are from demons. But some, not necessarily from God either way. But there are some things that are from God. I have to understand what they are. So I have to discern what is the information I'm coming from a man's point of view, from a demon's point of view, or from God's point of view. Discern what is right and what is wrong. That's how I understand discerning of spirits. Someone else may define that differently. I don't know what it is, but that's how I define it. So I can't answer your question what the word means to everybody else. Does it make sense? A diviner?
Yeah, it sounds like the same thing.
Well, in form of a diviner, with somebody who says, God told you to go do XYZ. Oh, okay, yes, sir. How do you know? Well, because I saw it in my dream of this and that and the other thing. That's, we consider that as a prophet. But not necessarily a prophet from God, just a prophet. Apart from anything. God told you to give me a $5,000 check tomorrow. Oh, wait a minute. So I can make a profit about anything. It doesn't mean I could be lying to you. And you have to discern whether I'm lying to you or not. And that's not necessarily easy to do. But that's, again, that's how I discern what it means when it's discerning a spirit. It's understanding what is from God and what isn't from God. To reject what isn't and accept what is. That's how I perceive it. Others may define it differently. In these instances, Jacob didn't have this problem. I'm going to end off, where it closes out today, with the last prophet, the prophecy of Balaam. The last prophecy, of course, Balaam doesn't go out and go divine his process trance-like state to God. And lastly, he understands, he saw it in verse 24, verse 1. Balaam saw it was good in God's eyes to bless the Israel, so he did not go as of the time toward divinations. He set his face toward the wilderness, of course, raised his eyes. It says here, and the Spirit of God was upon him. So at this point in time, instead of using divinations, where you're hearing Balaam speak, you're hearing God speaking. Because God's Spirit is now taking over and saying, okay, Balaam, this is what's going to happen. He obviously elevates himself up, how the guy who sees everything, whatever, blah, blah. A little bit of self-aggrandizement there at the beginning of the introduction. But eventually he points out that how good your tents of Jacob, dwelling place of Israel, like brooks and gardens of river, aloes planted by the Lord has planted by the water. So these great blessings, of course, come upon Israel in the third blessing. And, of course, Balak is infuriated and angry with him. In this third blessing, though, we have lots of information about them. About Agag, what happens to Agag, which we find out that, obviously, happens over many, many years. King Saul, of course, does most of that work. Then Samuel does some of that work, too, against the king of Agag. As well as, of course, Esther. Many years later, Mordecai and Esther. So a lot of things are happening, and we just go through this storyline, as I mentioned earlier. These are going through the storyline of the powers that be of his day. So Balaam's going through each of them. What happens to Moab? What happens to Israel? Edom? I bring your attention, however, to the Kenite. In verse 21, he saw the Kenite and declaimed his parable and said, strong is your dwelling, and set in the rock is your nest. For if the Kenite should be laid waste, till where can Assyria take you captive? Who is the Kenite? Kenite. I'll write the word out. Barbie's boyfriend. No. The Kenite. The Kenites were a group of people associated to Moses. They decided to hook their tents up and dwell with Moses' family line in their group. Why would they do that? Well, who were they? The Kenites were Moses' father-in-law's family. Now, he was from Midian, but his specific family was a small branch of Midian known as from the line of Ken. So, Kenite is Moses' family. Yep, his in-laws. Now, when they were in the wilderness, and Moses says, come with us, as he's talking to Hoab, which is his brother-in-law at the time, Raul's son, he says, come with us. He said, no, I'm going to my people in Midian. He says, no, come with us, God will bless you. And Hoab finally says, okay, fine, I'll come with you. Well, that okay, fine defined what happened to them from that point on. So Kenite wound up dwelling, their fen line, dwelling in within the territory of Simeon. That's the territory that they wind up inheriting, or part of that small point. Because it was closest to their Midianite life place where they dwelled, or their home. What was that question? Caleb. No, Caleb was from Judah. He was a He was from Judah. That I don't know. I believe it records in when they inherit when the spies went out. It says he was sent out for on behalf of the line of Judah. So I assume Caleb was Judah.
Were grafted into the tribe of Judah.
That could be. I do not know. That would be consistent with the prophets if that is what happened. If the mixed multitude was attached to Judah's tribe and given to that. And then the reason I brought that's a good point. If it's possible, I don't know if it's true or not, but it could be. Caleb was given the territory of Hebron, that area, that town, that region, which was his as an inheritance, with inside the territory of Judah itself. It's possible he wasn't from Judah, but I do not know. I assumed he was. Okay. If he was adopted to the Jewish tribe, that would be consistent with Messiah's adoption of us. Because any Gentile who's adopted in the tribe of Israel, what tribe did you get adopted into? Was the tribe of Simeon? No. Was the tribe of Levi? No. Was the tribe of any of the brothers, save Judah? No. How do I know that? What tribe was Messiah from?
Judah.
So who gets to adopt you?
Judah.
So by definition, and also when the prophets point out, you cling on to the tzitzit of one Jew, 10 men, the tzitzit of one Jew, be called by your name. It's important, it points out that it's referring to the tribe of Judah. Judah's the only one who's ever recorded the Torah or the Bible as being an adopting nation, where they will adopt somebody. So it would make sense that that theory could be true, that Caleb may not necessarily be a biological descendant of Judah, but either way, he was associated with Judah himself. But the Kenites, they went up territory of Simeon. They stayed somewhat nomadic their whole lives. But the blessing they give, that he gives for the Kenites, which I like the blessing, he saw them declare in the parable, "Strong is your dwelling, set in a rock is your nest." Because setting in Judah's rock, setting in Judah's nest is a good place to be. "For if the Kenites should be laid waste, till where can Assyria take you captive?" So the point is, in that statement, where can Assyria take you captive, is if anything, nothing can happen to Kenites. They hang out here. Assyria is the one that's destroyed. The point is, the point of the Kenites, where if it happen to you, oh, where can Assyria take you captive? Lost my place. That was verse 1. 22 of chapter 24. It was, "For if the Kenites should be laid waste, till where can Assyria take you captive?" If anything happens to you, Kenite, it happens to you, if you can be laid waste, then where can Assyria take you captive? They can't. If you're laid waste, Assyria cannot take you captive. Assyria has to be the one who takes you captive to make that happen. Because if you can be laid waste, where could Assyria take you captive? Assyria never takes the Kenite family captive. Now, Assyria gets wiped out by Kittim. If Kittim, the Greeks, come and trash Assyria, Assyria gets wiped out, but Kenites don't.
Kenites don't get wiped out?
No, they remain where they're at. Because, why is that? They're nomads. They're nomads. They travel. They don't build cities. They don't build walls. They're nomads. They stay in the nomadic territory, nomadic way of living life. That's how the life they lived. There is a gentleman, recorded in your Bibles. I can't think of his name off the top of my head. He instructs his descendants to stay out of the cities, don't build walls, you will stay in a nomad. I can't think of the guy's name off the top of my head.
I remember you came.
Yes, he was a gentleman. He was alive during the King Jehu's time, and he was the oldest man of his time. He was like 130 years old, 140 years before he died. But he told all his descendants, never live inside cities, never build houses, never grow crops, and God will bless you. Yeah, so he lived his whole life, and God said, as a result, because they were so diligent following their father, never, means for all eternity, will there ever fail to be a man from this tribe who stands before me. There'll always be somebody on earth from this tribe who stands before me in an honorable way. because of how they honored their father. So the Kenites, a similar nature, similar lifestyle of that particular tribe. I can't think of the guy's name off the top of my head. I've forgotten it. It starts with J. Anyway, so we learn from these tribes, these blessings, how far Balaam gets to see. How far does he see? 1,000 years or so. A little over that. Almost 1,300 years. He sees a long ways. Very far distance as far as how far he's seeing. And prophecy, he's going to have these countries, these nations. And so how far of it he can see, because he's the man with the, whose eyes are opened when they're closed, when he's asleep. He sees all this stuff. What does it tell you about the Apostle Paul? How much does he understand? Well, Balaam and the Apostle Paul are symbolic of each other in many ways. So how well does the Apostle Paul see? He has to see as well as Balaam does. The Apostle Paul knew or knows what the future holds and what he was planning, what God intended for happen to him, and how he's going to address the nations and be a prophet to them, just like Balaam was a prophet to them. The Apostle Paul goes through a life cycle that is similar to Balaam's life cycle because they're supposed to be symbolic of each other. Yes, David.
Paul might have seen a lot when his eyes are closed.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just like...
Balaam.
Balaam, thank you.
Yeah, when his eyes are closed.
He never talks about what his visions were or what he learned, why he was blinded, but it was so much so that when he went, he realized that he needed to reread all the Torah and the prophets because he had understood them completely without a Messiah.
Yeah, totally differently before. Yeah. He had to relearn them all. So yeah, he had to understand a tremendous amount. Note, he was taught by Gamaliel, but he's a very well-educated individual. As far as the Torah, the prophets, and the concepts of what God intended for life to be like. He understood that very, very, very well. Obviously, in order to have gotten the authority from the high priest to go out and hunt evildoers. Important individual. You don't get that assignment without being somebody of value. So Apostle Paul got that. He elevated himself up of his own knowledge and understanding, and then relearned it. So he now understood all of the Pharisees taught and understood. He maintained himself saying, I am still remain a Pharisee. So he maintained that lifestyle. But also, I just know all the Gentiles have to understand, as well as how Messiah opened them up to them and expounded the verses to make them see. So he understood a tremendous amount to be who he was.
And he calls himself an apostle.
Yeah, yes, exactly. He's a follower of the Messiah. So he became a very important individual. We have a lot of writings of him. He's not the most, but he became a very important individual. As far as how Gentiles understand things, he became the most critical one for all of us. Any questions or comments? I'm out of time again. We're just doing good. Paul was very important. So was Balaam was very important. They were critical items in part of the story, as far as what God's trying to explain to us, to help us to see so that our eyes were being opened, unlike their eyes, which weren't open initially. Any comments or questions?
I just wanted to say Joshua 14 is where it says that Caleb, son of Jephunneh, Kenizzite,
okay. So then you have to be adopted. Thank you. It was Joshua 14. Well, so Caleb went up on behalf of the tribe of Judah. So in order to do that and not be from Judah, he'd have to be father of Kazim, which is... then he'd have to be an adopted individual. Kenaz, brother of Caleb, conquered it. Okay. Son of Kenaz. I'd have to look that word up. I don't know. I do not know. I don't know if Kenite or Kenazite is the same word or not. Any questions or comments? Do we understand Balaam better?
Yes.
So why it's here? Do you understand what Apostle Paul's connection to him is?
Yes.
And why God has the picture of Paul showing up way back in Moses' time? Yes. So we understand why the Gentiles were important, what the value of them were, and why God wanted to bring them in so that they would understand and see too. Yes?
Well, after Jesus died for us, don't you think God is only, you know, supposed to be open to people that believe that Jesus is the Christ, and Jesus is God? I mean, you're talking about Balaam and the Old Testament and how God talks to people that are Gentiles, but are things different now? that after Jesus died, don't you think God should only be open to talking to people that are...
It may sound like
an odd question, but it only makes sense to me, you know, that
if they have to proclaim
that Jesus is the one.
Right. If I understood your question well, I may not, but if I understood it well, your comment is that, all right, so we have... Did I erase it already? No, I didn't. So in case of Balaam's time, not having the Spirit of God in him, necessarily, for a long period of time, he would get it sometimes for prophecies. And of course, Apostle Paul also similarly has the Spirit of God in him at times, but not during his entire existence. So in these events, when it says the Spirit of God came upon Yeshua and remained, which was a bizarre thing, that was a new thing that didn't happen before when Yeshua got baptized. So that Spirit of God remained with him at that point in time. So when Yeshua was baptized, that the Spirit of God remains. Now that event, the Spirit remaining, was a unique thing that happened to him first. No one else got that experience. All of the records of God's Spirit coming upon someone was a temporary event for an hour or a day or a month, and they vanish and go away. You know, the Spirit of God was not a remaining event. So after he died, baptism, Messiah got that first. After he died, that Spirit, of course, given to many people. They could also then, assuming they believe in him, would receive the same Spirit. So that Spirit of God then transfers to people, many people, multiple people, which includes Jews and Gentiles. After his death. So in this case, any point in time, this Spirit then transfers from any person, another person, to another individual. These individual people now have a part of God in them, a part of the Creator. A spirit of God, or you have the Spirit of God in you, means a part of your Creator is inside of you. That's the idea behind it. So the Spirit of God inside people, you now have a part of God in you. That's the idea of having God's Spirit. If you have God's Spirit, you have God. That's the association. In this instance, when Paul, of course, gets this process, he gets baptized. He goes through the whole rigmarole as far as how God happens to come upon him. We've read the story before. He now has the God's Spirit inside of him. Well, we have to be careful. Don't confuse necessarily someone with God's Spirit in you as being someone who speaks to God. Because it doesn't always happen that way. There are still those who are considered prophets. They still exist. We still write about them in the Bibles. There are actually people who can still prophesy things in the future that are very few of them around, who still are God obedient. So God doesn't necessarily speak to everyone the same way or communicate them with the same technique. He may speak to you differently than he speaks to me. He may use different tools for me versus the tools for you or an individual. That doesn't mean we don't have the Spirit of God in us. We have different forms in which God communicates with us in our spirit. So we're all different. We're all unique individuals. So we have this Spirit of God in us that may remain with us now. We have a portion of it that he doesn't necessarily speak the same way, the same person, everybody, all differently. He speaks to us all uniquely. So even though this may be true, that we have the Spirit of God in and God still speaks to us through them, doesn't mean he speaks to the same way he would necessarily speak to Balaam or Saul or Apostle Paul. It wouldn't necessarily speak the same way he spoke to those two as he would to us. Each person is uniquely different. It's their own way in which God communicates. You may respond to one instruction he gives you and not to another one. We have our own colored glasses on, so to speak. We see certain things and others get filtered out of us. We don't notice them. So a prophet's job, however, is to take the glasses and set them aside. A prophet's job is, okay, show me everything so I can put it together and then explain it to somebody else who this message is actually for. That's a prophet's job. They're not always good at it, but that's their job. So Balaam's task as a diviner, Saul's task as an explainer, their job was to take what God had, package it up and say, this is what God's trying to say, and hand it to you. That's what a prophet would do. Or the apostles did the same thing. Take what God gave you, He explained it to you very, very well, or however way he wished to explain it to you. Now explain it to other people that they may understand and see and receive the same way. So God can use His Spirit and help you then follow what that instruction is. So we still have individuals recorded here, we have lots of them, who teach us what God's intent was behind His instructions. And He talks to each of us distinctly differently. We're not all the same. Does that make sense a little bit? So yes, you're right in that He still communicates with His Spirit to many different people, but in many different ways. Not necessarily the same way to each individual citizen. Whether it be a Jew or a Gentile, male or female makes no difference. Each of us, He speaks to us differently now. Each person is His own unique communication because I am my own person. I choose to follow God, and you are also. We each have our own relationship with Him that is unique and distinct. It's like your relationship with you and your parents. It's distinct between you and them. Your sibling may have a different relationship. Yes?
I would just add to that, He speaks to us as individuals, but the bottom line is he may say something to her different than to me, but it will never contradict.
Right. Yeah, it's the
way
He speaks.
And that's how you'll know
it, right.
If you're hearing from the Spirit of God, yes. If it's this. So test everything.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Which we discussed earlier, the distinguishing of spirits between what is from God, what isn't from God. So yeah, He says the same type of thing, but He communicates with us differently in how He communicates it. Because I won't respond the same way you would necessarily respond. Does that kind of make sense? I hope. If I understood your question, that's what I got.
Weaving His will into society.
Yes, that is a fair statement. That is true. Any other questions or comments? Let's go with a prayer. Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank You for Your wisdom and kindness upon all of us, Father. Thank You for opening our eyes that we may see. We wish to see Your word and Your ways, Your strength and Your wisdom. Show us, Father, what is fair and just. That we teach and show and explain what You show us to our friends and family and loved ones. May we be people who see You and are not blinded. We praise You, Father, and ask Your blessing on the rest of our Shabbat. We glorify You, Father, in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.